Hi, I'm Alan Chartok. Delighted to be in conversation today with Sonia Shah, an investigative journalist and author of critically acclaimed and prize-winning books on science, human rights, and international politics. Her latest book is The Fever, How Malaria Has Ruled Humankind for 500,000 Years. The New York Times described it as a tour de force history, and Time magazine called it rollicking. The book is based on 5 years of original reportage in Cameroon, Malawi, Panama, and elsewhere. It was long listed for the 2010 Royal Society Winton Prize for Science Books. Her popular TED Talk on malaria has been viewed by more than 250,000 people around the world. Selected as the 2014 Ottawa Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz, Shah is a frequent keynote speaker and has lectured at universities and colleges across the country, including Columbia's Earth Institute, MIT, Harvard, Brown, Georgetown, and elsewhere. Her writings on science, global health, and politics have appeared in a range of publications from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Le Monde Diplomatique, to Scientific American and Foreign Affairs, and has been supported by the Nation Investigative Fund and the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. Shah was born in 1969 in New York City to Indian immigrants. Growing up, she shuttled between the northeastern United States, where her parents practiced medicine, and Mumbai and Bangalore, India, where her extended working-class family lived, developing a lifelong interest in an inequality between and within societies and the role of science and medicine in modern life. She holds a BA in journalism, philosophy, and neuroscience from Oberlin College. And to find out more about Sonia Shah, head to www.soniashah, that's one word, Sonia, S-O-N-I-A, Shah.com. Welcome, Sonia, and so glad that you could be with us, and congratulations on being named the prestigious Ottawa Fellow.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Let me start by asking you why you decided not to follow in your parents' footsteps and be a doctor.
Well, I tried. I started at Oberlin College as pre-med. I took a bunch of biology classes, and then, you know, the next step up was organic chemistry, and that was sort of the stumbling block for me. I was taking philosophy classes and neuroscience classes and writing classes, and I just loved all of that so much more than the organic chemistry. So I switched, and I decided to become a philosophy major, and I left the pre-med behind.
When I was growing up, Oberlin was everybody's number one pick where I grew up. Did it leave a permanent impression on the way in which you travel?
I think it did. I mean, I think wherever you go during that time in your life would probably leave a lasting impression, you know, because it's such a formative time. But for me, Oberlin just opened up the world of ideas for me, and I met some great people who I'm still really close friends with to this day. So yeah, it was hugely influential for me.
Now, some people think it's a little too far to the left in its orientation. I knew a kid who had just gotten a tour and who came back and said, "My God, they kept lecturing me." I'm wondering whether or not that has affected you specifically in terms of, you know, your approach to these issues that you've done so well with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a real hotbed of leftist thought at the time when I was there, and I'm sure that's still true. What I did when I was there was a lot of journalism. You know, I started at the student paper, and I ended up the editor-in-chief at the end of my senior year there. So for me, it was really about grappling with those ideas critically and, you know, covering them as a journalist. And so I became very familiar with those ideas, but I wouldn't say that I kind of bought it all line, you know, hook, line, and sinker. But certainly, it was really interesting and provocative to kind of, you know, have to grapple with those ideas. I mean, it was very confronting. All the politics there are very confronting. It's not something you can just kind of not engage in.
I have two very good friends who, years before you were born, were editor of the paper. And I just wondered, they put everybody's picture up on the wall after your editor or not?
They didn't do that when I was there. No, we had a really crappy basement office. It was, you know, fluorescent lights and it was dark all the time and no natural daylight at all. So it was not the kind of place you'd put any kind of like ornamental display at all.
Sonia, tell me about the word investigative. We have a wonderful investigative reporter who's here, Rosemary Armeo, and who takes her life in her hands. She's in Mexico and all these other places where there's high crime and reporters are at risk. What does the word investigative mean to you?
Well, it's really about, you know, not accepting material sort of on its face value. So what I try to do in science reporting is to look at the results that come out of sort of the scientific method, right? But instead of just saying, oh, scientist X had some result and just sort of uncritically reporting on that, and the investigative part is to look at it critically and think, okay, well, is this new? Is it interesting? Why? What are the other elements that shed light on this finding? What have other people found? Is it different? Is it the same? You know, that kind of thing. So for me, it's really about digging. But you find the facts that are interesting, and then you start digging.
When I hear the word investigative, I always think dangerous. Have you ever felt in danger because of the work you've done?
I have, but not because of the investigative part. I mean, I did a book on the drug industry, and I was looking at the experiments they do on people to, you know, get results to get their drugs approved. And a lot of these experiments were taking place in poor countries on poor people. Yep. And this is a very secretive part of the drug industry, and I wanted to write about it. So there's a, you know, it was a lot of investigative work, but a lot of that really was me sitting at my computer and finding documents, you know, and just digging through lots of really, really technical documents to figure out what was going on. I didn't feel in danger while I was doing that. But then to make it an interesting story, because part of what I do is try to bring investigative journalism and a narrative writing style together. So to do that, I've had to travel to places where, yeah, I didn't feel particularly safe. But it wasn't so much because I was trying to find information. I was trying to kind of understand a place that I had already done all the investigative work, you know, that had already been behind me already.
So when they do the movie about you... was there one moment when the dark music will come on behind you when you're Robert Redford like walking around a drug company and a burly guard comes up and puts his hand on your arm and says, "What do you want here?" I mean, is there anything like that?
I'm afraid not. So it's going to be kind of a boring movie. Yeah, it didn't really happen that way for me. I mean, because so much of what I found out was just hiding in plain sight. You know, it was just all these documents. It's just, you know, it takes a lot of time and effort to kind of wade through them and to understand the technical lingo that they use to kind of decode what is actually going on. You know, so that was really what that investigation
And they
was
put
about.
It there. They put that information there, Sonia, in order to comply with government regulations? Is that why they even bother to do it or put it out there?
Well, there's a number of different things that they put out. One is, you know, they have to recruit patients. So to recruit patients, they need to publicize the fact that they're doing an experiment, at least to some people, right? So they get people to enroll. Then they have to explain the experiment to the physicians and the other clinicians who are doing it. So that's all written down, too. Oftentimes, they want to report to their shareholders about, oh, look, we have this, you know, fancy new drug in development, it's probably going to be really great. We're doing experiments now. So all of that gets reported in different ways. They also do some reporting to the government, but it's basically optional. So sometimes there is that you can get your hands on, and sometimes there isn't. If the drug actually moves forward and they start filing, you know, approval requests to the FDA, then all of that's available too. You know, they don't give everything, but there's enough available. You can start to kind of piece these fragments together and figure out what was going on.
Is there a particular drug that you worked on that really piqued your interest and makes the point? I once met a doctor who did say to me, I said, "Would this drug be good for me?" He said, "No, first the animals, then the Europeans, and then Americans." That was exactly his words. I think he thought he was being funny, but he said it. So is there a drug that somehow screwed some people up?
Well, what I was really looking at is the experiments that lead up to the drugs. You know, because it was really easy to kind of look backwards and see, oh, there's a botched trial, there's a botched trial, there's another, you know, screwed up experiment that left people, you know, injured or dead. But what I wanted to do is to kind of follow these experiments prospectively. So like from starting now and looking forward, you know, just pick a few, watch what happens to kind of get more of a sense of what is the everyday cost of this. Yes, there's these sort of outliers that, you know, maybe are catastrophically bad, but maybe the most of them are fine. You know, I don't know. So this is what I wanted to investigate. So I picked a handful of drugs and I just watched them unfold over time, which is also, practically speaking, was one of the only ways I could do it, because the documents that are available like, you know, just for a limited amount of time. Like I said, like the recruitment documents is available for a limited amount of time, and then it just disappears, especially for experiments that fail. And 90% of drugs that start in development don't get approved, you know, so most drugs that go into the experimental stage actually do fail, you know, and then they basically vanish. You know, the drug companies don't talk about it anymore. They don't publish papers. They don't publicize them. They don't go to the FDA to try to get it approved. Nothing. So watching these drug trials unfold over time was really the most sort of practical way that I could watch this happening. So the drugs I followed, it was really interesting because every single one of them entailed some kind of infraction, some kind of transgression of people's human rights or safety.
For example?
For example, there's a drug I followed called nitazoxanide, and this was a drug that was for these acute infections that lead to really bad diarrhea, in particular, cryptosporidiosis is what it was called. And this was a problem in HIV-positive people. And this was in the 90s, before there was antiretrovirals, all these great drugs we have now for HIV-positive people were not available. So there's all these opportunistic infections people were getting, and one of them was this horrible crypto diarrhea. And it literally is life-threatening. And so this drug was being developed for that, and they're trying to do clinical trials, these experiments on people, and they wanted to test the drug against placebo, meaning give some patients who have crypto diarrhea the drug, and then give some patients who have crypto diarrhea nothing, and compare how they do, with the hopes of the people who got your drug actually do better than the people who got nothing at all. And that was okay in the 90s because there wasn't anything else you could give these patients anyway. So it wasn't like they were getting a worse deal than they would have otherwise, right? Anyway, lo and behold, these antiretroviral drugs come on the scene as these experiments were ongoing. And so nobody wants to be in the experiment anymore. So this drug company has kind of gotten screwed. Basically, this much better drug had become available in the United States. But they went to the FDA, and the FDA said, look, if you want to get this drug approved, you need to do experiments on people. You know, you're not going to be able to get people to line up for an experiment like this here in the United States because everyone's going to have a better drug available to them. But why don't you go overseas to places where there's lots of people with HIV who have crypto diarrhea and who don't have access to this wonderful new drugs that we have here. And that's what the company did. So they ended up doing an experiment in particular. The one I looked at most closely was conducted in Zambia, and it was conducted on a number of very, very ill, malnourished, HIV-positive toddlers. Mm-hmm. And about half of them died. And they didn't give any of these kids the drugs that would actually save their lives, which was antiretroviral drugs, which they could easily have done. But those drugs were not available in Zambia. People there didn't even know about them. So they got the experimental drug. A number of kids died. Some kids got better with this new drug. And the company took the results back to the FDA, got their drug approved. And they're using the drug now for kids who get crypto diarrhea, very mild cases of crypto diarrhea that you can get from like a dirty swimming pool. And the people in Zambia, at the time I was doing my investigation and wrote the book, had no access to this drug. It had never been approved in Zambia. So, you know, they wouldn't, even if they could afford it, it wasn't available at all in that, you know, because it wasn't licensed to be used in Zambia. The company had never applied for that. And even the hospital where this experiment had taken place didn't have even a small supply of this drug. So to me, that was just really striking example of the exploitation that was really kind of commonplace in this whole trend.
We're talking to Sonia Shah, award-winning journalist, author, and 2014 Ottawa Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. So, Sonia, when you were doing this work, did you find that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, may have developed a little bit of a what we call a captured relationship with the drug companies?
Yeah, that's definitely a problem. I mean, I don't blame the FDA in a lot of ways because this government agency, I think it's the smallest government agency in our entire government, and it has a huge purview. I mean, what it's supposed to do is, you know, it's just hugely time consuming and resource intense, and yet they have this tiny budget and this tiny staff, and yet they're so important. I mean, their regulatory function in our society is so hugely important. So yeah, they've slowly started taking more money from drug companies. You know, drug companies pay fees to get the FDA to review their applications faster. People who work at FDA move on to work to drug companies and back and forth, you know, that whole like kind
revolving
of revolving door. So yeah, that is definitely happening. But we have to step up and really fund this agency properly in order to stop that.
Yeah. It is always astounding to me how the FDA puts their hands on something, says, okay, go ahead, put it out there. And then we find out after millions of people use it that it's not quite right.
Well, you know, they openly say that the big experiment, the major clinical trial is, of course, after the drug's launched.
Sure.
Because so many of the drugs that are developed now are taken by so many people, you know, I mean, statin drugs.
Sure. But we do find out that there are problems once millions of people start to take the drugs. Have you dealt with that at all?
I've written a bit about that, but, you know, I think there's an inherent problem, which is that, you know, these side effects, it might only affect one out of 100,000 patients, right? You can't necessarily find that out in a clinical trial unless you can actually enroll, you know, hundreds of thousands of patients, which is hugely expensive and, you know, just impractical in terms of actually getting drugs to market ever. So, you know, I think the flip side of it is we are over-medicating ourselves. You know, we're seeing all these more and more side effects because, you know, so many people are taking these drugs. And to what end? You know, a lot of the drugs for chronic conditions that are approved today, to my mind, you know, they've been approved based on sort of surrogate markers. So you look at statin drugs, you know, they're approved because they lower cholesterol, which is good. But do they actually prevent heart disease events? We don't know. Do they actually lengthen your life? We don't know. You know, we're not doing those kinds of experiments. So just to get the drug approved, all you have to show is, well, you know, my drug lowered cholesterol.
But we are living longer.
We're living longer compared to 100 years ago, sure.
Even the way I'm looking at it, 40, 50 years ago, when people were dying, the average age of death may have been in the 60s and then 70s and now 80.
So Absolutely.
Some of these are working, but you're right. And so, okay, let me move on to your seminal work in malaria. Now, that's an interesting one. How many people die of malaria every year?
Estimates vary. It's probably between 600,000 and 1 million people die of malaria every year.
That is extraordinary. And where does it occur?
Well, malaria used to be pretty much all over the temperate and tropical world. We had a lot of malaria in this country right up until the 1920s or 1930s. Today, most malaria deaths occur in sub-Saharan Africa, but you'll find malaria cases across Asia, Latin America, and Africa as well. Malaria is creeping into southern Europe, and you know, even we're having cases in California and stuff. So the spread of this disease is changing.
So what is it? What is malaria?
It's actually caused by a little tiny parasite called Plasmodium. It lives inside the gut of a mosquito and inside the bodies of the, you know, blood-filled hosts that mosquitoes bite. So there's malarias of humans, there's malarias of birds, of chimps, of lizards, of goats, of all different kinds of creatures have their own malaria parasites. We ourselves as humans, we have at least five malaria parasites, that species of malaria parasites that plague humans.
So, Sonia Shah, tell us what your contribution to the whole malaria spectrum in terms of your journalism was.
Well, what I tried to do in my book, The Fever, is to answer the question of why we still have so much malaria in the world. You know, this is not Ebola, it's not SARS, it's not, you know, a very strange new disease. We don't know what to do about it. It's fully preventable, it's fully curable, and we've had good preventive methods and we've had effective cures for hundreds of years. So it's not like we just figured this out. And yet, 1 million people die every year because of the bite of a mosquito. And so what I wanted to answer is, why is that? You know, and I really started off the investigation into the story not knowing the answer, you know, really wondering why is that? Because I had lived in Panama and Australia in tropical parts of those countries and there was no malaria, right? But I'd also lived in India and there was tons of malaria. And so it was, to me, it wasn't a simple geographical fact, you know, that there's some places that have malaria and some places that don't. That was clearly not the answer. So there was something else going on. And that's really what I tried to figure out in the book. And I think that's the story I was telling in the
book. And what did you conclude?
Well, it's a very pernicious parasite. You know, there's definitely scientific challenges in dealing with this disease. The parasite itself shapeshifts 7 times in its life cycle. So these different life stages not only look totally different, they have totally different physiologies. So if you came up with a drug or vaccine against one stage, it would maybe do nothing at all against another stage. They can hide in your liver for weeks, for days, for months, for years. Actually, some malaria parasites can even hide in your liver for decades. So, you know, that's scientifically pretty complicated. It's also complicated by the fact that it's carried by mosquitoes, and the mosquitoes are also a pretty wily bunch, very hard to control. We create mosquito habitats just by living our lives, so it's not easy to just get rid of all of them. And you don't need a lot of mosquitoes to have malaria around. So, you know, even if you were able to kind of control the mosquito population, you have to do more than that to get rid of the malaria. So scientifically, it's a hard problem. It's a hard problem economically because, you know, malaria causes poverty. You know, poor people get a lot of malaria, obviously, but malaria itself makes people poor because it strikes during harvest season, especially in rural areas. That's, you know, really economically devastating. And actually, it's been quantified by economists at Columbia University that if you have malaria in your society, it decreases your GDP by 1.3% every year. And that's, you know, compounded year after year after year. And some of these places have had malaria for hundreds of thousands of years. I mean, obviously, they're not, haven't been economies for that long, but from the very beginning have had this drain because of this disease. So malaria occurs in really, really remote, poor places right now. So even if you do come up with like a great drug or vaccine, you know, how do you get it there? How do you get it to where it's needed when, you know, there's no roads, there's no electricity, there's no refrigeration, there's no clinicians, there's no doctors to deliver it. You know, so that's a big economic challenge. So there's a scientific challenge, an economic challenge, and then there's also a cultural challenge because people have learned to live with this parasite the way, you know, the way people in our part of the world live with colds and flus. You know, we don't really like rush to the doctor, you know, if you have a cold or a flu. You just kind of tolerate it, you live through it, you miss some days of work or whatever. We don't rush out to get medicines and vaccines and get treated and diagnosed and everything. And we really don't even take kind of simple preventive measures like, you know, washing our hands or staying home when we're sniffly and that kind of thing. It's because we think it's normal, you know, it's normal to have colds and flus in the winter season. And that's how people in malarious parts of the world think about malaria. So that makes it really, really complicated because the people who kind of stand to benefit the most from actually attacking the disease kind of care about it the least. You know, they're not the ones who are going to rush out to keep the repellents on and tuck in their bed nets and go to the doctor and get the drugs and take them all and, you know, all of that stuff. So that's a really big challenge, too. And all of that together means that, you know, countries that have a lot of malaria tend to not have a ton of political will to get rid of it. You know, just like the United States. I mean, the cold and flu is not, you know, I mean, we have a lot more public pressure to find cures for cancer and heart disease, you know, than we do for getting rid of colds and flu here in this country. And I think, you know, that there's parallels to that in sub-Saharan African countries with malaria.
So where's the honor roll of the societies that have wiped out malaria?
Italy wiped out malaria. They had a terrible malaria problem in Italy, especially in the southern part of the country. And it took probably, you know, 50 years of concerted effort for Italy to get rid of malaria. But they did it. The United States, you know, malaria was the American disease for hundreds of years. You know, we had it from the very beginning of European settlement in the 1600s, and we didn't get rid of it till the 1920s, 1930s. So that's, you know, over 300 years of malaria in this country. And it took, you know, 100 years of concerted effort to get rid of malaria in this country.
Now, when somebody gets it, Sonia, the reading that I've done just indicates that they can have it for the rest of their lives. Is that right?
Well, there's different species of malaria parasites. So some of them can last in your body because they hide in your liver for years and years and years, and they can sometimes come out and cause relapses. So if you've ever had that kind of malaria, you basically can never, you know, donate blood again, for example, because you might still have parasites in your blood. There's other kinds. Actually, the most deadly kind of malaria is falciparum malaria. It's caused by the parasite called Plasmodium falciparum, and that's the one that's responsible for like 90% of the deaths from malaria. And that one actually doesn't stay in your body for very long. It can't survive in your body for more than, I don't know, a week or two. So you're not going to relapse from that. However, many people have mixed infections, and it's difficult to know, do you only have falciparum or do you also have falciparum plus some other ones? So we kind of err on the safe side and say, if you've had malaria, you know, you still could have it like kind of the rest of your life, because it's hard to know which ones you were actually infected by.
So just for all of the Americans who are listening to this, who are going to go somewhere where there still is malaria, what should they do?
Well, this is the irony, is that it is very easy to avoid malaria. You know, you take prophylactic drugs, and you can get those at your travel doctor. And those are drugs actually that are similar drugs that you would use if you actually got malaria. So it's not that they prevent you from getting infected, but you start taking them before you start traveling. And so you have this malaria-fighting drug in your body. So when you do, if and when you do get infected, it's sort of immediately taken care of by the drug that's already in your body. So we can take the drugs, we can use repellents, we can sleep under bed nets. Lots of people, you know, if you sleep under a ceiling fan in a room that has window screens or air conditioning, you've really reduced your risk of getting malaria by a huge amount.
So what are some of the competitive diseases that we could look at that have been historical, that have caused great chaos, and that we either dealt with better or worse than malaria?
Well, cholera. Cholera is a great example, and that's the subject of my new book, actually. And we had, you know, terrible pandemics of cholera in the 19th century in this country, New York City. You know, thousands of people would die within weeks. You know, Baltimore had terrible cholera epidemics, too. And we got rid of that by, you know, a really huge step forward in how we live our lives, which is by, you know, separating our waste from our drinking water and our food. And that meant creating, you know, public water works, filtered water, and sanitary systems that actually, you know, took our waste away from cesspools and our rivers and things and dumped it much farther out or treated it first and got rid of it. So we weren't living around it all the time and it wasn't contaminating our food and water. And that really made, you know, the modern city possible. And it was very much triggered by these terrifying epidemics of cholera that happened in the 1800s.
We are talking to Sonia Shah, award-winning journalist, author, and 2014 Ottawa Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. So, Sonia, what's wrong with the way we teach journalism in America?
You know, I don't know what's wrong with how we teach it because I did not study journalism myself. I am just a practicing journalist. I taught myself on the job. I can see what we're doing wrong in terms of publishing journalism. You know, I don't think we have enough room for in-depth journalism today. And, you know, that's the crisis that's throughout the industry, trying to figure out who's going to pay for this kind of work. And now, you know, there's some philanthropies that are popping up that are helping support it, but I don't think that that's sustainable over the long term. So we still need to solve that crisis of who's going to fund kind of the long-term watchdog kind of journalism mm-hmm. that we really need to have a functioning society.
Sure. So, you know, we've heard over the years that some of the major newspapers prefer that you didn't go to J school, that you go to Oberlin and study liberal arts or study economics or study something like that. And then, you know, we can teach you the journalism. You don't need to learn the techniques here. Is that something you're saying or am I misinterpreting it?
I mean, that was my personal experience. You know, I'm working with some journalism students now at SUNY New Paltz, and they're wonderful. So I think, you know, being educated in journalism can be great, too. You do need to have a wide education, a broad education, I think, to be, you know, a well-rounded journalist. But that can happen in a number of different ways.
Is the crisis, the contemporary crisis in what people are going to do with their newspapers? People aren't reading them the way they used to. You can't monetize the web the way we thought at some point some of us thought was going to happen, or at least not yet. And as you say, investigative journalism is longer rather than shorter term. So do these all come together somehow?
I'm not sure what you mean. Can you?
No, sure. So in other words, right now, the newspapers are in crisis. Yes, we're all together on that. They're in great
Absolutely.
Crisis. They don't know where
yes.
to go. They don't know how to fund themselves. People are getting laid off by the droves. We used to have 100 guys or women over typewriters in a big room. Now you see four guys at the end of the room. And investigative journalism takes investment. And the New York Times may have that money, but maybe some of the other smaller places don't have it. And so this is a sort of potential death knell to investigative journalism, isn't it?
Well, it is and it isn't. I mean, it also means that there's a lot more stories out there that need covering, you know. So that's part of the difficulty in becoming a journalist, you know, pursuing a career in journalism, I think, is finding stories that you can write that are important. And I think there's a huge opportunity now because, like you said, you know, there's a lot fewer people out there, and yet we have these huge issues happening in our society. This is a time of great change and disruption, and we need to be looking closely at how all these factors are kind of playing out. So yeah, on one hand, there's less financing, but on the other hand, there's a lot of opportunity because there's a lot of important stories out there that need to be told.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you a nice person?
I would think so.
Uh-huh. You see, I just interviewed your colleague Rob Maraldi on his new book on Cy Hirsch. And it turns out, at least according to him, that Cy Hirsch is a hell of an investigative reporter, but maybe not the nicest human being who ever walked the face of the earth, leading me to conclude that maybe you need to be more mean-spirited in order to be a successful investigative reporter. That's why I asked you that trick question.
I don't agree.
You don't?
No, I don't. No, absolutely not.
You think you can be a nice person and still ask the hard questions and not be suspicious of those around you?
Well, you can be nice and still be suspicious. I mean, what's being nice? And I think actually being nice, if by nice you mean empathizing with multiple points of view, I think that is actually really useful in being an investigative journalist, because it's easier to see different sides of the story. You know, you're not, you know, if you set up your story as, okay, this is the bad guy and this is the good guy, and I'm going to attack the bad guy because he's telling me a lie, you know, you're getting a part of the story, but you're not getting the whole story, because usually there's multiple personalities. Everyone thinks they're doing the right thing. You know, I mean, to me, those are the more interesting stories. I mean, when you look at the drug industry and the experiments they do on people, and I talked to the doctors who did those experiments on those dying African babies, you know, and they felt like they were doing the best they could, right? And they were. You know, if you look at their entire situation, they were doing the best they could. You look at the mother who brings her child into an experiment, you say, oh my gosh, this mother like allowed her child to be experimented on. Isn't she awful? Well, no, because she also had, you know, she also had limited choices, and this was where she thought she could get the best care for her child. So I think putting all that together and empathizing with all those different points of view, you know, allows you to see the story in all of its sort of complexity.
Well, what if the drug company is, frankly, after the almighty buck? And maybe the doctors who participate, doesn't everybody rationalize their behavior?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's true. So there's mixed motives always. But what I found, particularly in the drug industry, covering the drug industry, was that it's a lot of good people with good intentions who together, either because they're not thinking through the social implications of what they do, or because of just, you know, sort of self-motivated behavior.
Or self-deceptive.
So you hide certain truths to yourself, or you fool yourself into thinking you're doing something that you're really not. Or you just don't think about it in those terms because you're just thinking in a very narrow sense about, you know, your own well-being or that of your colleagues or that of the company and not how the company functions in the world. You know, I think when you put all of that together, institutions end up making decisions that are not very humane. You know, I think that that kind of has a, there's a whole dynamic that happens in group think that would not be possible as individuals.
What about the economic implications of what you're saying, Sonia? I mean, in other words, we know that newspapers are hurting. We know that they're more dependent on advertisers than ever before. We know that investigative reporters sometimes upset the apple cart. Putting all of that together, what do you got?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I'm a freelancer. I've always been a freelancer. So, and I've been really fortunate in being able to pursue the stories that interest me and getting financing from publishers and foundations as well. So for me, it's, you know, I can't really speak to journalism as a field. My own path has been very particular, and I've been really lucky to get support to do the kinds of stories that I really care about.
Well, nevertheless, there you are, Ottaway Fellow, teaching journalism to aspiring journalism students. They're looking at you. They want to know what's possible out there. And it seems to me that if, in fact, newspapers have money to cover the Board of Education, maybe, but not investigative reports, that we may have a crisis.
I think we do have a crisis. I think we absolutely have a crisis. But I still feel like, you know, this is such an important thing to do that if you have a passion for it, we need to find ways to do that. And we forge the path by walking it. You know, if we look for creative financing, we look for other entities that might want to support our work. But if you have a passion to do this, it is so socially important to pursue this kind of work.
Well, not to be contentious, but you come from a family with physicians as parents. You went to a first-rate college, many of which now cost $50,000-$60,000 a year. A lot of the kids at New Paltz, of course, are having to borrow to pay, you know, a couple of $1,000 for an education. What do you tell them in terms of making a living, making a go at it?
I'm not sure I do tell them anything. I don't have to tell them what to do. I'm sharing my experiences, and I think it's incumbent upon all of us to, you know, you take what you want from it. I don't have a prescription, add hot water and stir, and then you'll get your perfect life, or you'll get this goal or that goal, or do as I do. I don't think that that's how we forge our paths anyway, and I don't really see it as my role.
Great answer. Let me talk to you about the places you've appeared, the New York Times, Le Monde. So how do you pitch your stories to these editors?
I guess the same way. I mean, I've pitched 100 times more stories than I've actually gotten anywhere. So I've had certainly my share of failure. And like you were alluding to before, there are certain stories that just don't get told because nobody wants to pay anyone to write about them. And that's a problem. Luckily now, there's more interest in disease, climate change, environmental disruption. And I think it's because we're finally realizing that these are actual crises that are going to affect us. It's not just, oh, some Africans and, you know, oh, some people far away that we don't have to care about as Americans. We're all safe and happy here. You know, I think the mindset is changing. And unfortunately, because it's the reason why is because we're seeing the effects of this happening right now. You know, we're seeing the effects of climate change and new diseases popping up and the problems with environmental disruption and resource scarcity and all of that. So I think tying my stories to some of those big issues of the day that people are really worried about and that publications do want to cover because it is a real, you know, it's an active concern in people's lives today has really helped those stories get out.
Could you give us an example? Now hitting the nitty gritty, you go to the editors of the New York Times or they come to you or to one of the other places like Le Monde. How does it work?
I guess it happens slowly where, you know, sometimes what's happened is I've written something for, you know, a smaller news outlet. And I was really supported when I was starting out by the independent press. You know, I have to put a word in for that because independent nonprofit publishers were hugely supportive of my work and they actually paid me, which was great.
So for example?
For example, The Nation, the progressive magazine out of Midwest, St. Paul. Some smaller women's newspapers, feminist newspapers around Boston, online places that since defunct, you know, but were really supportive and allowed me to explore different stories and paid me to do that. So that was hugely useful for me.
So how'd you get them to do that? Did you have to go to them? That's a lot of time.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's part of being a freelancer. You pitch stories. I mean, you spend 80% of your time pitching stories, and then one out of every 50, somebody picks up and you get to write it.
Sonia, is that all about developing relationships? In other words, you get to know, there are a lot of grants people who have in at a major foundation, and they know who to call, and the person says, yeah, hello, Sonia, yeah, what do you got for me today? Or get out of here.
No, but I'm not that person who is connected by relationship, social relationships. My parents were immigrants. We weren't moving in circles where I would know, they would know anybody who was connected with, you know, the New York Times or Newsweek. I was not that person. I didn't go to journalism school. I didn't make those kinds of connections at all. So I was really just pitching editors cold. You know, I cast a very wide net and I came up with stories and I pitched editors who had no idea who the heck I was. And I just did it again and again and again and again. And finally, you know, some of them started to notice and started to say, oh, wait a minute, that's sort of an interesting story.
Yeah.
Random person who I don't know, I'm going to throw you a bone and let you write it. So slowly I got to know some editors and they got to realize that, okay, this person can actually write a story that she says she's going to write and do it on time. And so slowly, you know,
is that important,
built up relationships.
Yeah. Sonia, is that important getting it in on time? I have a wife who's an author.
I think it's huge.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's huge.
Yeah.
I think it's like 80% of the job, getting it done on time, you know, then doing what you said you were going to do. I mean, that's probably true for every profession, right?
Well, I think it's true. My wife, the author, she gets stuff in on time and it really... It really makes a difference in terms of the next person who you go to. Okay, so what don't you like about being a professor?
You know, I've only taught one class so far, Ellen, so I really couldn't say. But I really enjoyed it. I really find working with young people and, you know, people who are in this part of their education really rewarding. I myself am a mother of two teenagers, and my husband's a professor here in Baltimore. So we have a lot of college students and young people in our lives. And I really do enjoy working with people who are at that stage where they're trying to explore different areas and refine what they're interested in. And there's like an open mind to that part of your life that is just really wonderful to be around, that kind of energy. So I find it really rewarding to interact with people at the undergraduate level.
Sonia, how can you teach a kid to have character? You know, Freud said character, 4 years old, and it's over. Your character clearly is, you dismiss it, but you were the editor of the Oberlin paper with a lot of smart kids there. So you must know how to compete. You must know how to get it done. You got a kid sitting in front of you and you say, okay, you need to have the same values and the same basic character worldview that I have. How do you teach that?
Okay, I'll tell you the single most important thing I've done as a parent is to not have television in my house. That's the single most important thing I've done. And I really feel like you turn that tube off and then you just wait and see. You know, it's like planting a seed. You don't know what's going to come up, but you prepare the bed and you drop the seed in and then you just wait and see. And turning that television off for us, for our family, was huge because it just kind of took away that noise, that background noise, and that controlling voice of, you know, the corporate world that kind of comes through the box and all the advertising, et cetera. So as much as I enjoy all the content, and it's not that we don't watch films and videos and television programming, we do, we absolutely do. But turning off sort of the stream of advertising that comes out of broadcast television for kids, I think, in our family was a huge thing. And I don't think anything else I did was really, you know, really made that much of a difference one way or the other. I mean, you do that one thing and you sort of just wait and see what happens.
Well, I don't know about that. Let me contend with you on that. I'm a junkie and that's just nothing I can do about that. You know, really old, bad Westerns, for example. And many life lessons have been taught to me by the Lone Ranger, you know, and others.
Sure,
but,
sure.
But, you know, we have two children. They're in their 30s now, upper 30s, but when they were coming up, there's a school around us, I won't name it, that doesn't believe in television. And so the kids would run in some cases, straight on our kids, and run for the thing that had been denied to them forever, turn on the television set. So, you know, it seems to me it's not a matter of nothing, but a matter of balance.
I think you're right. This is how it went down for us, is that, you know, as a mother of young kids, I was freelancing and I needed time to work, and the TV became my babysitter, you know, especially in the mornings. I'd turn the TV on, the kids would sit in front of it, they'd get their juice bottles and they would just sit there quietly for like an hour. And then, you know, sometimes the hour would bleed into 2 hours because I'd get involved in my email, my shower, blah, 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 et cetera. And so this was going on. And then my husband was doing some research in Panama. And so we all went with him. You know, I was freelancing, so I didn't have to be home. And the kids were really small. We stayed in this little, like, military barracks around the Panama Canal Zone.
Sure.
And, you know, we hadn't ever seen the place they had put us up in. You know, it was just kind of reserved for these scientists working on this project. So, you know, we walk in, and I'm supposed to be home with these two little kids all day long, and there's no TV. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, what am I going to do? There's no television. What are they going to do in the morning? How am I going to get anything done? So the next morning, you know, we go to bed. We wake up in the morning and we just walk out to the living room. I give the boys their juice and they literally just sat on the couch and stared at the wall for an hour. And I was like, oh, my God, is that what it's about? Like, they just need to kind of veg and rest their eyes somewhere, you know? And so when we came back, we got rid of the TV. And they were young enough at that time that they didn't really seem to notice. You know, they still had that kind of downtime. And it, for us, it just, you know, I wasn't good at setting limits. I mean, I guess it depends on your style. For me, it was really hard to be like, okay, only an hour. Okay, only 2 hours. Now turn it off. Now turn it off. You know, just that whole kind of supervisory role you have to play to limit screen time and to, you know, make sure they're following whatever standards you've put up in your house. I was really bad at that. So to me, it was just easier to not have it. You know, and to not have to just not have to nag them and say anything. And, you know, and it's part of, you know, just my own laziness as a parent. I couldn't like oversee it properly. So just getting rid of it was a lot easier. And it meant that they, you know, they got bored. They played blocks. They went outside. They, you know, they came up with their other stuff they did, you know. And certainly I'm sure when they went to their friends' houses, they were so excited to watch TV. But that's fine, you know, it became like a treat, like something fun to do. It was like watch TV. All the friends probably thought it was so boring, but, you know, they, and I think also it took a little bit of the mystique away over time, you know. Yes, sometimes they'd go to like my parents' house, so they have a huge TV and the kids would just get sucked into it, and they'd be so excited. But, you know, as they grew up, they became less and less interested. It became less and less kind of, you know, alluring to them. And I think also at the same time, since we didn't have it at home, they were developing other interests that, you know, slowly kind of sucked up more of their time. So
makes
there was
sense.
Less left over for TV watching.
Makes sense. 60 Minutes does the investigative reporting is fairly important, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's great stuff on TV. So it's not, I don't have anything against TV programming. I think a lot of TV programming is really great. I do have a thing, I have a problem with the advertising.
Sure.
You know, and I understand that's the business model, but, you know, but I think it's a very pernicious system of watching it, you know, just what it does to your mind, and there's no natural end to it. So for me, I, you know, I'm a very visual person, so watching these moving pictures and getting these messages is very mesmerizing. I'm not good myself at turning it off once I turn it on.
Sure.
You know.
We're talking to Sonia Shah, who is an award-winning journalist, author, and 2014 Ottaway Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. So when you look towards those children who you got away from the television, what's become of them?
Well, they're, you know, they have one in high school. He's a junior. I have one who's about to enter high school as a freshman next year. And, you know, they love their shows. They watch, you know, The Office, and there's a bunch of shows they watch on their little computer, on the computer, the family computer, or their iPods. You know, so they're normal kids that way. But they also have a lot of other interests that they've been able to develop, and I think it's because they had, you know, time in their lives that, you know, those hours a day that they might have spent watching shows, they actually were, you know, able to pursue other interests. So, you know, they skateboard and they play music and drums and guitar, and, you know, they ski and they, you know, they do other stuff, just normal stuff that lots of other kids are doing too.
Who are your heroes?
My heroes?
Yep. I mean, would I.F. Stone, a great investigative reporter, be a hero? And he did much, because I know him a little bit, he did much of what you do, which is to look at things and just pore over things and come up with stuff that nobody else had looked at, government reports of one kind or another. But he's sort of out of it now. I mean, he's gone. Do you have a hero, somebody that you say, hey, you know, that's the person I'd like to be or be like?
Well, I've always been very inspired by Barbara Ehrenreich. I just think she's, you know, she's a great journalist and she's a great social thinker. And she's also just really funny and she tells great stories. She's a great storyteller. And I was very influenced by her work as a young person. So she's definitely been an influential figure in my life. Lori Garrett is another person who I've been really influenced by her work. You know, she wrote some amazing books about public health and disease, and she really brings in, you know, the history and the science and the story, and she does amazing reporting. And so her work has been, I'm a huge fan of her work, and it's been very, very influential on me too, very inspirational.
Do you involve yourself, not, you know, professionally, but do you get involved with politicians in terms of, this is a politician where the social outcome will be much better than the person they're running against?
I would say probably not. You know, I mean, I'm a voter, of course, and I support, you know, I'll support candidates who I believe in, absolutely. But, you know, I don't really involve myself in sort of policy making or advocacy. I really am feel much more like a witness, you know, that I'm observing and witnessing.
Yeah, but if you are a person who believes that we could do better or worse in our way in which we deal with, for example, disease, and then you take a look at somebody who is more likely to advocate for ways in which we could, for example, help in Africa, whether it's a George Bush, who believed in that, I believe, or a, you know, Barack Obama. There are choices to be made in terms of what you're writing about and the outcome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's...
But what's your question?
My question is, therefore, as a investigative reporter who is looking at what's wrong, do you look at people who are likely to make it right? And do you ever do anything about that?
I guess I haven't really encountered a single person who I thought could make all the difference. You know, to me, these problems are very complex and there's many layers. So, yeah, you could put the right person on top of the whole kind of garbage pile of this problem. But, you know, unless you really get underneath it all and you change sort of systemically how we think about it and how we, you know, so I'm really more interested in that kind of social change, of changing people's minds about how they think about what's going on around them, how they think about their place in the world. And I think that is really what can change the whole outcome, much more than let's select the one person and pluck him out and put him on top of the garbage pile. We need to, you know, all of us think about problems in a new way, in a more constructive way, more analytical way, you know, whatever it is. And then we together come up with our solutions. You know, it's not, and I'm not saying I have any solutions. I don't. I see the problems. I think we need to think about them.
Well, you've seen societies where they took the bull by the horns and got rid of malaria, for example, as opposed to those who did not.
Yeah. Okay, but you know how they got rid of malaria in Italy? It was Mussolini. You know, Mussolini, and hundreds of people died in his fascist program to drain the wetlands around Rome. So it was a huge social change, but was it one that was fair or gentle or kind or just? No, it was not.
Very interesting. Very interesting. So you are the daughter of Indian immigrants. How has that affected your outlook in life? In other words, there are many Americans who are basically isolationist. There are, you know, let them fend for themselves over there. You know, your parents are physicians. They came from, you know, a different culture. How has that affected you?
It's everything. I mean, it's really shaped my whole outlook on, you know, on life generally. And that's been true, you know, since I was little, obviously. They come from a very working class background. So my parents, and they used to send me back to India in the summers when I was a kid growing up so I could spend time with my uncles and aunts and cousins there. And, you know, they both come from really big families of five or six siblings, none of whom were educated. All of the family resources went into educating, you know, my father in his family and my mother in her family. They were the only ones who kind of were able to lift themselves out of that.
Was the expectation,
the rest of them lived.
Sonia, was the expectation they would give back? In other words, if people were supporting them, they would support, which is something that we see in Indian families every once in a while, that the children are raised with the expectation that they will do something to help the parents.
Sure. And not just the parents, but the entire family.
Sure.
And yeah, they do that. That has been their role, absolutely, in their families.
And this has affected you in terms of the
Because from a very young age, I saw how my own relative lived in extremely different, you know, circumstances than the way we lived here in the States. You know, my uncles and aunts and my grandparents in Bombay lived in a tenement building in a ghetto. It was a two-room apartment. There was about, you know, 8 to 10 people slept in there. There's common latrines at the end of the hall. That were filthy, that were not very well plumbed. There's lots of disease. There's lots of poverty. There was no trash pickup, so there was like rag pickers who would come. I mean, it was like 19th century, what you might expect in a 19th century city here in the United States. And yet that was where my family was living. You know, that was my life. That's where I came from. That's where my father grew up. And so seeing that life and then coming back here to the States where the streets are clean, there's electricity, you flush the toilet and everything just like magically disappears in like a sparkling waterfall. That contrast confused me as a child so much. And it's really been sort of the guiding, you know, question in my life is, why do we live in a world where some people have so much and other people have so little? You know, why is everything so lopsided?
Well, we're out of time, and we've been talking to Sonia Shah, award-winning journalist, author, and 2014 Ottawa Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. You can find out more about Sonia at www.soniashah.com. Sonia, I can't tell you how much we appreciate your spending all this time with us. Students at New Paltz are very lucky to have you, and the Ottawa program is really first rate. So congratulations on having achieved this.
Thank you so much. It was really fun talking to you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.